Good morning, everybody. Today we're going to be talking about dietary factors that affect risk for cancer, risk for recurrence, risk for treatment failure, and overall survival. But first, I'd like to make a brief mention about genetics. What if cancer runs in your family? Well, good news, genes impel, but they don't compel. Said another way, bad genes may load the gun, pardon the metaphor, but it's actually poor lifestyle factors that pull that trigger. And said yet another way, bad genes may stack the deck against you, but healthy lifestyle choices can keep you in the game. Some fascinating research was conducted by Danish scientists looking at cancer risk in adopted children. And what they found was that if the birth parents died of cancer before the age of 50, that had absolutely no effect on whether the children whom they gave up for adoption got cancer. However, if the adoptive parents died of cancer before the age of 50, then the children whom they adopted had a 500% increased risk of cancer mortality. Clearly, birth parents pass on genes, but it's the lifestyle habits of the adoptive parents that seem to make all the difference. Another Scandinavian study conducted at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden looked at identical twins, who, of course, share every single gene, but they don't share the same risk of getting cancer. Now, some fascinating data on immigrants also supports the same conclusion. Among Japanese men in Japan, prostate cancer is diagnosed in about 8 men per 100,000. If those men move to the United States and adopt the Western diet, that number goes up 400% within the first generation. Similarly, Japanese women with breast cancer, quite rare in Japan, but when they move to the United States, they end up with breast cancer at the same rate that American women get breast cancer, and that is four times as high. And according to a study at the University of Miami School of Medicine, first-generation immigrants to the United States from Mexico, Puerto Rico, and Cuba actually have a 40% increased risk of getting cancer within the very first generation as compared with their compatriots who remain behind in their native land. So, despite our fear about genes, they do not always express themselves. And no matter if both of your grandmothers died of breast cancer, you may have the power to avoid playing out that same genetic tendency. The most hereditary aspect of cancer is not your family history, it's your family dinner table. So whether it be for primary cancer prevention, prevention of recurrence, or support during, after, or even instead of treatment, the power of food to harm or heal has been largely overlooked by our medical practitioners and consequently by medical consumers. Smart practitioners and consumers pay a great deal of attention to diet. Here's why. In 2007, the American Institute for Cancer Research and the World Cancer Research Fund published Food, Nutrition, and the Prevention of Cancer, the most comprehensive report on diet and cancer ever completed. Over 7,000 scientific studies were independently reviewed by an expert panel of 21 scientists, and they developed their recommendations for cancer protection. Among their conclusions, diets that protect against cancer are mainly made up of food of plant origin, and the recommendations of this report also apply to cancer survivorship. Dr. Richard Béliveau, an internationally recognized biochemist from the University of Quebec, author of the best-selling book, Foods That Fight Cancer, stated simply, change your diet change your cancer risk. Plant-based food is the best thing you can put on your plate to protect you from cancer. And according to the EPIC study, the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer, increasing our fruit and vegetable intake by only 150 grams a day, which is the equivalent of one small apple, could prevent 36,000 new cases of cancer each year in the United States, and worldwide, more than 300,000. In fact, a diet high in fruits and vegetables is going to protect us against at least 15 different types of cancer, including breast and cervix and prostate and colon and lung cancer. Dr. Colin Campbell, the lead researcher in the China Oxford Cornell Diet and Health Project, which is the world's most comprehensive study of diet, health, and disease ever completed, found very strong correlations between the changeover in China from the traditional Asian plant-based diet to a Western diet of meat and dairy and fat, and increased rates of cancer and obesity. Obesity is a known cause of cancer. It also negatively affects cancer survival. More than 121,000 cases of cancer each year are caused simply by excess body fat, according to the American Institute for Cancer Research. And that includes 49% of endometrial cancer cases and 35% of esophageal cases, 28% of pancreatic cancer cases, 24% of kidney cancer cases, etc. And here is a similar set of statistics from the National Cancer Institute. Not only risk for cancer, but actually estimates of cancer deaths avoidable through dietary change, which run as high as 75%. And that includes 75% of prostate and colorectal cancer deaths, 70% of breast and pancreatic cancer deaths, 50% of endometrial and gallbladder cancer deaths, etc. From my experience, I will add about 75% of all deaths from malignant melanoma can be laid squarely at the foot of diet. Now, why is nutrition so important? Because cancer patients typically do not die of their tumors. They die of malnutrition, toxemia, and/or opportunistic infections. Proper diet can address all three of those issues. And that is why, despite whatever treatment we choose with our doctors, we also need to be dealing with cancer in our kitchens. Now, there are many, many important ways, multiple advantages, and various mechanisms by which dietary change affects not only risk for cancer, but actually survival and recurrence and outcome. So let's take a look at that list. First of all, good diet is the best thing we know for avoiding malnutrition. It can help minimize the negative side effects, both short and long term, of chemotherapy and radiation treatments. It can help optimize their positive effects, making them more selectively toxic to cancer cells and more effective against cancer cells while protecting healthy cells. Good diet can also promote new healthy cell growth and healing from surgical procedures. It can improve immune system function, and that's going to include increased T cell counts, improved T helper suppressor ratios, that's the turn on, turn off effect of the immune system, increased natural killer cell counts and NK cell activity, and improved macrophage function, which is the Pac-Man effect of the immune system. Dietary factors can also modify hormones that feed hormone-dependent cancers like breast and prostate and ovarian cancer. It can influence tumor growth factors, slowing down disease progression, and reduce inflammatory processes. That's just the first half of the list. Good diet can also inhibit tumor angiogenesis, which is the ability of the cancerous tumor to develop its own blood supply so it can nourish itself. It can also stimulate apoptosis, which is programmed cancer cell death. Now, contrary to popular opinion, cancer cells are not these strong, aggressive, virulent cells that we think they are. Cancer cells are actually quite weak and sickly cells, and they are supposed to self-destruct, but something gets in the way, and they don't get the message that they're supposed to commit suicide. What gets in the way? Poor diet. Now, good diet can also encourage cell differentiation, which is often underdeveloped in cancer cells. What does that mean? They're not clear about their job description, and so they go rogue, right? They go places they don't belong and do things they're not supposed to do. So with proper diet, the cells can settle down and do what they're supposed to be doing. Good diet can support detoxification, both renal and hepatic detoxification, specifically phase 1 and 2 liver detox. Detoxification. Good diet can inhibit metastasis, help to prevent recurrence, extend the remission or disease-free interval, and increase survival time. Good diet can also improve quality of life. That means increased energy, decreased pain, improved appetite, normalization of weight, better elimination, etc. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, good diet can help empower a patient to participate in his or her therapy by making healthful lifestyle choices. Do you like these lists? I don't think I've left much out. I imagine every cancer patient would like to have a therapy that could accomplish these two lists of goals. I also think it's likely that every oncologist would be thrilled if his or her therapy could accomplish 25% of what is on these lists. But how many of you have ever asked an oncologist about nutrition? How many of you were really thrilled with the answer you got? Well, here are the responses that my patients typically receive. No, I don't want you to do anything nutritional because it might interfere with your treatment. Or, well, if you want to waste your money and have expensive urine, go ahead and take nutritional supplements. Or, no, nutrition is only valuable for preventing cancer, but once you've been diagnosed, there's absolutely no evidence that it's going to change your outcome. You'll hear how wrong that is. Number 4, we'll just eat a balanced diet. Now, I can't officially define that because we didn't study that in medical school, but whatever it is, just do that. And finally, we have 2 more, actually. Eat everything and anything you possibly can. Not good advice. And perhaps the worst advice of all, eat a high-fat, high-protein, high-calorie diet because we have to keep your weight up and your strength up, right? Guess what? I am all for weight and strength. But if you do that by indiscriminate choices of high fat, high calorie, and high protein, you're going to feed the cancer before you're going to feed yourself. Now, the truth is, there are literally thousands, if not tens of thousands, of research studies published in hundreds of biomedical journals around the world that document the role not only of diet in cancer prevention, but specifically the role of diet in cancer survivorship. And we're going to review every single one of those studies right now. Or not. I was just checking to hear if you were listening. What I will do is give you a few highlights of that research. So this first landmark study done in the 1990s, this is by Drs. Hoffer and Pauling, who tested a diet of unprocessed foods, low in fat, low in dairy, and low in sugar. There were 129 patients in the study. Every single one of them got conventional oncologic treatment. There were 31 patients who received no nutritional support. Their average survival was less than 6 months. But there were 98 patients who did get the nutritional support. Their average survival was more than 6 years. And that included patients with adult leukemias and lung cancers and liver cancers and pancreatic cancers, the stuff that typically doesn't get better so easily, and also patients with female-related cancers who lived an average lifespan of another 10 years. In another study, Cancer Research Center at the University of Hawaii examined diet and lifespan of 212 female lung cancer patients over a period of 6 years. The more vegetables those patients consumed, the longer they lived. The group with the highest vegetable intake had double the survival time of the group with the lowest. At Tulane University, researchers looked at survival in pancreatic cancer patients on the macrobiotic diet. Now, I'm sure many of you know what macro is. High, it's all vegetarian, high and all cooked and high grain diet. It is difficult to find the ingredients, more difficult to prepare, and especially difficult on the taste buds, which is why 1,467 pancreatic cancer patients decided they'd rather die. But there was a small group of patients who did follow this difficult diet. And by the way, my diet is much simpler. But they did follow this diet, and more than half of them were alive after 1 year. And more impressive benefits were seen among prostate cancer patients who followed this diet and who averaged 19 years survival time versus matched controls who made no dietary changes and whose average survival was under 4 years. In other prostate cancer research at Harvard University, men who consumed a daily average of 30 grams of fat from red meat were 2.5 times more likely to have advanced prostate cancer or to die of prostate cancer than those who ate only 3 grams of fat from red meat. And in related research, men who ate fish at least 5 times a week had 48% lower death rates from prostate cancer than those who ate fish less than once per week. An Australian study published in the International Journal of Cancer found that women who survived ovarian cancer for the longest were those who ate the most vegetables, those who ate the most dairy were those who had the greatest risk of dying early. In a more recent study of ovarian cancer patients, and this one was done at MD Anderson Cancer Center, there were 51 women in the study with stage 2, 3, and 4 ovarian cancer. There were 2 diet groups, both of which were excellent. And one group got 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. The other group got 5 servings, but also supplemental concentrated fruits and vegetables in capsule form, and a vegetarian protein supplement. After 6 months, both groups enjoyed excellent quality of life and nutritional status. And what was most interesting was what happened after 5 years. The recurrence rate, the hospitalization rate, and the death rate were much lower than predicted. Statistically, about 60% of those patients should have died within 5 years. In fact, fewer than 10% had died. According to research completed at the Karolinska Institute on breast cancer, poor dietary habits were associated with risk for treatment failure among breast cancer patients, and it was recommended that every woman being treated for breast cancer take advantage of an adjuvant nutritional support program to improve her outcome. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, diet was correlated with outcome in colon cancer. And the researchers found that those patients who consumed a high red meat, high sugar, high fat, and refined carbohydrate diet had a 3-fold increase in recurrence of colon cancer or death from colon cancer, which led our friend Dr. Bailey Vogt to conclude, if I were asked to design a diet today that promoted the development of cancer to the maximum, I could not improve upon our present diet. Now, a cancer protective diet is going to do 2 intuitive things. Number one, we're going to reduce or eliminate the foods and beverages that get us into cancer trouble. And number 2, we're going to increase or introduce the foods and beverages that get us out of cancer trouble. So I'm going to start with the bad news first, and then we'll move to the good news. So let's take a look at the macronutrient group known as fats. Fats are relevant to cancer in 3 ways: the amount of fat, the type of fat, and the quality of fat. Now, traditional plant-based diets only contain about 15 to 20% total calories coming from fat, whereas the Western diet may have 50 or 100% total calories coming from fat, depending if that's all you're eating. Now, the reason that's important is that high levels of dietary fat are linked to increased levels of hormones, mutagens, and carcinogens, because these compounds are lipophilic. They love the fat, they live in the fat, they don't metabolize out of the fat. So if you have a high fat diet or a lot of fatty tissue on your body, you give those compounds an opportunity to go to work, and of course that's working against you. Now, furthermore, fat is a threshold nutrient. You reduce total calories coming from fat from 50% down to 30%. You're not going to find very impressive results as relates to cancer. And that's why the Women's Health Initiative study and the Harvard Nurses study concluded that reducing fat had no relevance to cancer. Fat, again, is a threshold nutrient, the magic window, 15 to 20% of total calories coming from fat. And by the way, those studies, which considered 30% as a low-fat diet, not only was that not low-fat, but they also did not distinguish between the types of fats. Now, we need to distinguish, certainly, and you all know there are two main classes of fats, the saturated fats coming mostly from animal sources tending to promote disease, and the unsaturates coming from plant sources and tending to be more protective. But we now have to look at the breakdown among the unsaturates, and I'm sure you've all heard of omega-3, 6s, and 9s, okay? If you're not a lipid chemist, you don't know exactly what that's all about, me neither, but let's take a few broad brushstrokes. So no food is 100% a 3, 6, or 9. We need combinations thereof. What's important is the ratio, because omega-3 fatty acids tend to boost up immune function, whereas omega-6s tend to suppress immune function. Again, foods are combinations. What's important is the ratio. We don't want an immune system turned on all the time any more than we want it turned off all the time. So a one-to-one ratio would be lovely, but what we have in the Western diet is actually an omega-6 to omega-3 ratio of about 25 to 1. So that's going to be 25 to 1 against your immune system. All right, now let's take a look at who is who. So we have the unsaturated fats, the omega-6s, which are these express concentrated oils like sunflower oil, safflower oil, soybean oil, corn oil, cottonseed oil, etc. And if you buy something made in pure vegetable oil, you can bet that that's pure omega-6. And we have also the omega-3s, the more protective fatty acids in wild fish and the sea veggies they consume in the wild, wild game, grass-fed animals, free-roaming hens and their eggs, raw walnuts, raw pumpkin seeds, fresh ground flax, and chia and hemp seeds. According to the Institute of Food Technologists, 1/3 of all cancer deaths in humans and dogs can be prevented simply by reducing omega-6 in the diet. And finally, let's talk about the quality of fats. Fats are very labile, especially these express concentrated oils. That means they're unstable, and they break down very quickly when exposed to air, heat, and light. When they do, they oxidize, they reacidify, they produce free radicals. We don't want any hydrogenated fats. What about partially hydrogenated? That's like partially pregnant. You either are or you're not. It was very nice last summer to hear that the FDA announced that the food manufacturers had to discontinue their hydrogenated fats within 3 years. Personally, I think we should do it right now, and so we don't have to wait for 3 years. And some very interesting information came to us recently, actually last summer again, from researchers at De Montfort University in UK, demonstrating that heating omega-6 oils like corn oil and sunflower oil produce toxic aldehydes, which promote the growth of cancer, at levels up to 200 times higher than are considered safe by the World Health Organization. Okay, let's move on to another macronutrient group. Let's talk about proteins. Again, two groups, right? So we have the animal-based protein, meat, fish, fowl, and dairy, and we have the plant-based protein, seeds, nuts, beans, and legumes, whole grains, etc. Now, we know that the animal-based proteins are more likely to promote cancer. A British study of more than 6,000 vegetarians found them 40% less likely to die of cancer than meat eaters. Animal products, of course, are frequently high in fat and low in fiber, both of which are risk factors for cancer. Charbroiled and cured meats are especially carcinogenic due to the heterocyclic amine and nitrate contents. And, of course, North American cattle are often treated with these bovine growth hormones, which stimulate the growth of hormone-dependent cancers like breast and prostate cancer. So does that mean that you need to be a vegetarian in order to fight cancer? No. First of all, some vegetarians are starchitarians. That's no good, right? A Coke and a Twinkie is a vegetarian diet, okay? That doesn't mean it's good for you. And of course, some people just simply do not have a metabolism that thrives on an all-animal protein diet, on an all-plant diet. But you certainly can substitute some of the plant-based proteins for much of your animal-based proteins. Now, according to Dr. Robert Good from Sloan Kettering, Dr. David Krzyzewski from Wistar, Dr. Campbell from Cornell, a low animal protein diet, less than 10% of the diet, helps slow cancer growth. And Dr. Campbell discusses an experiment in which test animals were given a powerful carcinogen that promoted rapidly growing liver cancer. As soon as the scientists swapped out the animal protein in the feed for plant protein, the liver cancer stopped growing just like that, which led him to conclude that carcinogenesis is turned on by animal protein and turned off by plant protein, even if that cancer is rapidly growing. And of course, here is the largest meat eater known to mankind, and we all know what happened to him. Now, another dangerous protein source is cow dairy, like milk and cheese, butter, ice cream, and yogurt. And a study published in the journal The Prostate, conducted by the European Institute of Oncology in Milan and the University of Montreal, looked at 197 prostate cancer patients and matched controls. And what they found was a significant increased risk of prostate cancer among those men who were consuming dairy products. Now, the Harvard Nurses study of over 80,000 women found that those who consumed 4 servings of dairy products a day had double the risk of ovarian cancer as compared with those who had less than 2 servings per day. And that's not due to the fat content, because women who consume 1 or more servings of skim or low-fat milk daily had up to a 69% higher risk of ovarian cancer as compared with those who consume much less. The Iowa Women's Health Study found that women who consumed 1 glass or more of milk per day had a 73% increased chance of developing ovarian cancer. And as far as I'm concerned, that means stimulating growth of already diagnosed ovarian cancer. And in the Physicians' Health Study, tracking 22,000 men for 28 years, researchers found an increased risk of prostate cancer for those who consumed 2.5 servings or more of dairy products per day, as compared with those who consumed little or none. Here is why. Now, many dairy products contain exogenous, extrinsic, added synthetic growth factors. We know that. But even organic dairy contains intrinsic endogenous growth factors, right? Because the protein that most strongly and consistently promoted cancer was casein, which makes 87% of milk, makes up 87% of milk protein. And even insulin-like growth factors are included in dairy product, which are produced by all mammals. So every single animal on the planet gives its young mother's milk because of these intrinsic growth factors that help that baby animal grow to maturity. We are the only animal species that consumes another species' milk. So somehow we're right and the entire animal kingdom is wrong. And furthermore, we consume that not just to the age of weaning, but we consume dairy products well into our adult years. So at beatcancer.org, we do diet histories of every patient we counsel, and that's been about 30,000 cases, and we have seen very strong correlations between a heavy history of dairy consumption and poorly controlled breast cancers, prostate cancers, ovarian cancers, and adult leukemias and lymphomas. All right, let's move on to carbs. Again, two groups, right? The simple refined carbohydrates like the white sugar and the white flour and the corn syrup and the soda pop, we know about that, tending to promote cancer, and the more complex carbs made up of whole grains and fruits and vegetables and beans, which are more protective. Now, why is that true? Because sugar is cancer's favorite food. Cancerous tumors are obligate sugar metabolizers. They uptake sugar at a rate of about 10 or 12 times the rate that healthy cells do. And that is why PET scans work so well, which is not an x-ray of your dog. PET scan is one of the most sophisticated tools we have for determining where cancer colonies lie in the body. And so the technician gives the patient some sugar water tagged with a radioactive isotope, and the cancer cells go, sugar, wow, gimme, gimme, gimme. They get all excited, they light up, and then you can see exactly where the cancer colonies are. So if you want to have cancer, you can either eat a lot of sugar or take a lot of PET scans. Only half joking. Okay, now sugar also suppresses immune response, and this chart shows the amount of sugar and what that does to an immune process known as phagocytosis. And you can extrapolate that 10 teaspoons of sugar a day can suppress that immune response by 50%. Now, it sounds like 10 teaspoons is a lot of sugar. It's really not when you think about all our breakfast foods, all of our snacks and desserts, all of our processed foods, the high fructose corn syrup that's in pretty much everything that's prepared. Not only is it not hard to get 10 teaspoons of sugar a day, it's hard not to get 10 teaspoons of sugar a day. And the USDA, Department of Agriculture, reported a couple of years ago that the typical American consumes 30 teaspoons of added sugar per day. That's pretty scary as far as I'm concerned. This group of researchers from Australia concluded that because sugar ingestion typically will stimulate insulin release, high levels of insulin and insulin-like growth factors may actually be causative of a wide range of cancers, including breast, colon, prostate, endometrium, and pancreatic cancer. It's also likely to be associated with more aggressive growth of diagnosed cancers, and that is because insulin and IGF inhibit apoptosis. Remember, that's that cancer cell suicide. They stimulate cell proliferation. They stimulate sex steroid synthesis, and they inhibit the sex steroid binding capacity of the body. According to new research that just came out January 1st from MD Anderson Cancer Center, sugar intake in mice comparable to levels in Western diets leads to increased breast cancer growth and lung metastasis. And that is why Dr. Patrick Quillen, the former director of nutrition at Cancer Treatment Centers of America, stated, trying to beat cancer while eating a diet that constantly raises your blood glucose levels is like trying to put out a forest fire while somebody's throwing gasoline on the trees. It can't be done. But of course, I'm not a great fan of the pink stuff, the blue stuff, and the yellow stuff. The Cancer Research Center in Bologna, Italy, concluded that aspartame causes a statistically significant increase in lymphomas and leukemias at dose levels very near to those to which humans are routinely exposed. The authors called for an urgent reexamination of permissible exposure levels. And so sugar may be safer, but you certainly don't want too much, and certainly not too often, because not only the amount of sugar, but even the frequency of ingestion of sugar is going to be relevant to immune function. 1 hour after ingesting a modest amount of sugar, you're going to have a 38% decrease in immune response. 2 hours later, the immune system is going to be suppressed 44%, and it's going to take over 5 hours before that immune system can finally make its way up to baseline. Well, 5 hours, that's just about time for another sugar fix, wouldn't you say? So we might be chronically immunologically suppressed. Oh, dear. So you can't have fat, and you can't have meat, you can't have milk, and you can't have sugar, and you can't have pasta, and you can't have bread. There's nothing to eat. You actually have to decide whether you want to die of cancer or starvation. Well, I want to congratulate you all for hanging in, because I'm going to go only to good news from now on. And the truth is that there are tons of cancer-fighting superfoods and plenty to eat. In a nutshell, we need 13 servings of fruits and vegetables a day with about a 3-to-1 ratio of vegetables to fruits. And if you microwave them, you get negative points. Okay. If you want to know about the German and Swiss and Russian research on microwaving, I have some materials at my table in the lobby there. Okay, so that's really the end of the bad news. Now I'm going to go with the good news. So let's talk about, first of all, the high fiber diet, looking an awful lot like the complex carbohydrates list. And fiber in the Western diet is maybe 3, 4, 5 grams of fiber a day, depending on your breakfast cereal. What we really need is 30, 40, or 50 grams of fiber a day. And then we're going to have a great deal of cancer control because the fiber can bind up and squirt out circulating hormones and carcinogens that promote cancer. And a high fiber diet is very protective, of course, of colon cancer, but we also know it to be protective against breast cancer, prostate cancer, and lymphomas, and probably a broad range of cancers. Dr. Dennis Burkitt, the fellow of the Edinburgh Royal College of Surgeons, and the doctor who gave his name to Burkitt's lymphoma, said, "Small stools, large hospitals." One of my favorite high fiber foods is the apple. But in addition to the fiber, which is so valuable, researchers at Cornell have found that the triterpenoid compounds in the apple peel, especially the peel of red apples, especially organic red apples, are going to be excellent for antagonizing a group of cancer, human cancers, liver cancer, colon cancer, and breast cancer. All right, let's take a look at the carotenes. Now, the carotenoids are a group of 600 different carotenes. These are natural plant chemicals, and not just beta carotene, not just in carrots, not just in orange fruits and vegetables. We have carotenes that are red and yellow and purple and green and great. Why do we care? Two main reasons. Number one, immune support. Thousands of studies on file at the National Cancer Institute showing how carotenes support our NK cells, our T cell populations, etc. And then also antioxidant support, which will neutralize the free radicals that damage cellular DNA with tens of thousands of hits per day and move those cells towards cancer cells. One very famous carotene is known as lycopene, very rich in tomatoes, but also in beets and in pretty much all red fruits and vegetables. And lycopene got a lot of press for its ability to protect against prostate cancer, but as you can see, there's a full range of cancers that lycopene protects against: oral cancer, breast, pharynx, esophagus, stomach, and colon cancer. At Carmanos Cancer Institute in Detroit, oncologists evaluated the effect of lycopene on 30 men with local prostate cancer. They were all scheduled to undergo prostatectomy within 3 weeks. But for that period of time, researchers either received 15 milligrams of a high lycopene tomato product or a placebo. And then at the end of the study, when the glands were removed, the researchers found that the true lycopene group had smaller, more confined tumors with signs of decreased malignancy, increased regression, lower Gleason scores, etc. More good news comes to us from berries. Berries contain a lot of phytonutrients or plant-based nutrients. One of them is ellagic acid, which is a very powerful anti-angiogenesis factor. Remember, we want to interfere with the ability of the tumor to develop its own blood supply so it can nourish itself with all that fat and meat and dairy and sugar that we've been talking about. And berries also contain anthocyanins and proanthocyanidins, which are pro-apoptosis factors, and they stimulate the death of cancer cells. And berries have been extremely protective against a wide range of cancers, including colon and liver and brain and ovarian and lung and renal cell, nasopharyngeal, and triple negative breast cancer. All right, more good news. Pig out on crucifers. So the cruciferous or brassica family, you all know we've eaten a lot of that this weekend. Cabbage and broccoli and cauliflower and bok choy, Brussels sprouts, kale, collard greens, mustard greens, etc. They're very valuable, primarily because of their indole and sulfur compounds, which can support important liver enzyme systems and detoxification pathways that can take dangerous hormones and dangerous carcinogens and neutralize them very, very quickly, in fact, in a matter of days. So very protective against hormone-dependent cancers like breast and prostate cancer, but also protective against lung cancer and bladder cancer, according to research at Roswell Park. Not only risk for those cancers, but also aggressiveness of those cancers. More good news, green tea. Now, green tea contains polyphenol compounds known as catechins or EGCGs, epigallocatechin gallate. It took me a month to learn how to say that quickly. Very, very valuable for their antioxidant capacity, but also there are 300 research studies of green tea that demonstrate more than 12 mechanisms that by which green tea can antagonize cancer, including anti-angiogenesis and apoptosis. Green tea is effective against pretty much any cancer you can mention, the esophageal, stomach, pancreatic, colon, bladder, prostate, lung, breast, liver, uterine, and ovarian cancer. Now, whether the green tea you consume is just a nice beverage or it actually provides therapeutic anti-cancer value depends on the amount of the catechins and EGCGs. It depends on the growing methods, harvesting methods, and brewing methods, and on the amount of green tea that is consumed daily. And if you've got all that in place, you actually have the endorsement of the National Cancer Institute for an anti-cancer beverage. If you'd like to learn more about the green tea research and how to optimize its therapeutic value, I have one of my Immune Perspective magazines out in the lobby, and you can take a look at that. All right, more good news. Flax seeds, we mentioned them very briefly as a major source of the omega-3 immune-boosting fatty acids. And flax seeds also contain these wonderful phytochemicals called lignans, and which are fibers that can bind up hormones and carcinogens that promote cancer, especially breast and prostate cancer. And I kind of promised that I would do this University of Toronto study now. And so let's take a look at that. This is the famous MUFFIN study. It was done on 32 women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, all of whom were expecting to undergo surgery within a month. But for 30 days, one group consumed a daily muffin containing 25 grams of flaxseed. The other group consumed some other muffin. A month later, the tissues were biopsied in the laboratory, 34% slower rates of cancer cell growth, 31% higher rates of cancer cell death, and 71% less activity of a breast cancer-promoting oncogene in the flax muffin group. Similar research was done at Duke University, a couple of studies. Apparently, muffins are not macho, and so it wasn't a muffin study, but the scientists actually provided 25 or 30 grams of ground flaxseed per day, and they got similar excellent results. So what does that translate into? About 2 heaping tablespoons of flaxseed per day. And if you've never done flax, please do not start at that level because your body will thank you in some really uncomfortable ways. You can go with 1 teaspoon of ground flax and increase gradually till you get up to the optimal level. Let's talk about more good news. To soy or not to soy? That's the question. So soybeans are very good sources of phytoestrogens. That's all some oncologists need to hear. Don't touch it with a 10-foot pole, right? However, phytoestrogens are weak plant sources of estrogen, and they can compete with and blunt the effect of the more dangerous aggressive estrogens by actually crowding them out of the receptor sites in breast tissue. And the key class of chemicals in soybeans is known as the isoflavones, and one particular isoflavone is genistein. Genistein is an excellent angiogenesis inhibitor. And of course, there is much controversy about soy, and so a lot of doctors just tell patients, don't touch it with a 10-foot pole. What I have noticed, and I'm not an expert in the soy literature, but I have reviewed a fair amount of it, it seems to be that when we stop to define the amount of soy, the type of soy, the quality of soy, and the circumstances of the person considering the soy, much of that controversy kind of melts away. So if we're doing soy, let's get the right kind, right? Let's get organic, non-GMO soy for sure. Let's get a high enzyme soy. So that would be the fermented soybean paste that we have in miso. It would be tempeh as opposed to tofu. It would be soy milk that we buy out of the refrigerator at the store, as opposed to the kind that we buy in the shelf-stable carton that we only put into the refrigerator once we open it. Asian soy is usually highly fermented, and you have an ad in your program booklet about that, and much more valuable, but not particularly pleasing to the Western palate. Okay, and a meta-analysis of 18 different breast cancer studies done over the last 30 years or so, found no evidence that intake of isoflavones increased risk of breast cancer. In fact, they showed overall evidence of risk reduction and synergistic effects with the anti-breast cancer drug tamoxifen. Now, if you are concerned about taking soy, please don't let me try to talk you into it. There are a number of people who will not do well on soy, no matter what kind of soy it is. And so I'm hoping that by the time we're finished today, you're going to have enough other choices so that if you're uncomfortable taking soy, you will have still an excellent anti-cancer program. More good news is garlic. And garlic is at the very top of Dr. Bailivo's charts, which, by the way, I have at my table, that show which foods reduce human cancer growth by up to 100%. That is primarily due to the natural killer cell activity, according to the Karolinska Institute. How much should you have? Maybe 2 to 3 medium cloves a day. You want to have a social life, that might not be your best choice. And so you can go with the aged garlic extract, which is odorless and tasteless. Excellent inhibition of breast and prostate and stomach, colon, brain, and lung cancers. And finally, the last food that I want to mention today is the shiitake, one of many foods in the Asian mushroom tradition that have anti-cancer and therapeutic abilities, but this is probably the only one you're likely to find in your food store, so that's why it's part of a food talk. And the shiitake contain lentinin, which can increase our total T cell and T helper suppressor ratios, as well as our natural killer cell levels, which are all key players in the immune response to cancer. Shiitake can also stimulate endogenous within the body interferon and interleukin production, your own private immunotherapy in biologically appropriate doses. And there are truthfully hundreds of other foods that address multiple cancers via dozens of different mechanisms through hundreds of phytonutrients at various stages of cancer. They are documented in vivo, in vitro, in animal and in lab studies, and in human studies. And they are in my latest book, the ABCD Cancer Guide, which I have a few copies of in the lobby if you're interested. Happy to autograph any book, just an additional $100 charge. So there is potentially, I hope you will agree, tremendous anti-cancer power in your kitchen. Now, ultimately, the best way to reverse cancer or prevent recurrence is to provide an inhospitable environment, an internal milieu that is simply unfriendly to cancer. A number of years ago, there was a classic debate between two scientists, Louis Pasteur and Claude Bernard, and they were arguing about the best approach to controlling malaria. And Pasteur said it was important to kill every last mosquito, and Bernard said, nah, I think we ought to drain the swamp. Now, Pasteur got all the glory with his germ theory that led to pasteurization and antibiotics in the Pasteur Institute, and nobody ever heard of the other guy. But on his deathbed, Pasteur admitted, you know what, you were right all along. Le terrain, c'est tout. The terrain is everything. All right, so I think cancer treatment is similar. While our oncologist's goal is to kill every last cancer cell, which is really hard to do. Number one, you can't see them. Number two, the body's producing new ones all the time. And number three, sometimes you destroy the patient in the process. But while the oncologists are doing the best they can with that, we need to be focusing on the breeding ground. We need to be addressing our biological terrain. Now, this is not my idea. A Nobel Prize was awarded to Dr. Otto Warburg in 1931 for discovering that cancer cells and healthy cells do not survive in the same environment. In fact, they don't thrive in the same environment. So cancer cells need a low oxygen and highly acidic, high sugar environment. Healthy cells need a high oxygen, highly alkaline, and low sugar environment. And guess what? He's not alone, because back in the 1880s, Dr. Stephen Paget launched his seed and the soil hypothesis, in which he stated the likelihood of cancer to grow depends on its environment. Sir William Lane, former Royal Surgeon of London in the 1920s, stated cancer cells will only grow in suitable soil. And in the year 2000, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, 2006, stated promotion is reversible depending on whether the early cancer is given the right conditions in which to grow. So that is the message that I have been trying to share since I founded the Center for Advancement in Cancer Education back in 1977 when I was two. We're going to skip those. Actually, I founded this center after the death of my 30-year-old husband to cancer. He left me with two babies and a broken heart, and above all, a burning desire to make a difference. I wanted to prevent at least one family from having to undergo the terrible tragedy that ours had. And I'm happy to say that I found the bless in the mess with BeatCancer.org, which is now in its 38th year of service. Our mission is to reduce cancer suffering by providing research-based education on how to prevent, cope with, and beat cancer through diet, lifestyle, and other immune-boosting approaches. And we're very proud of our accomplishments in the last 3.5 decades. We've provided diet and lifestyle training to more than 60,000 prevention seekers. We've provided continuing education for thousands of healthcare professionals. And we have provided individualized one-on-one counseling on a donation basis worldwide to nearly 30,000 cancer patients. We ask for donations. If those patients can't donate, we help them anyway. And by the way, if you know someone who could benefit from our services, we do it by telephone anywhere in the world, or sometimes Skype. Please pick up one of our brochures at my information table. Direct them to the beatcancer.org website. I also hope you'll get involved with our work. All of you are so passionately interested about this field. Sign up for our free e-newsletter. Visit our website and read the hundreds and hundreds of articles that we have published there. I hope you'll consider joining our ambassadors program. We have an online holistic cancer educator certification program in which I teach in 10 hours what it took me 35 years to learn. We would love for you to consider that. We're looking for ambassadors all over the world to help us do the work that Anne and I have embarked on over these many years. If you like today's talk and you can think of someone you wish had been here to hear it, of course it is being taped, but it's also in my book, Kitchen Chemotherapy. If you buy into the theory and you'd like to know just how to do it practically, these are my two recipe books. They are based on all the principles I just discussed. They are very, very simple, very tasty recipes, and they are gluten-free. There are other educational materials, of course, on our website and here at my information table, and I would be very happy to speak with you personally if you want to stop by and say hello. I'd like to end with three quotations quite worth noting. In 1995, Drs. Kohlmeier and Associate urged in their article on dietary modifiers of carcinogenesis, realization of the potential of foodborne substances to reduce the human burden of cancer will only be achieved with better measurement of dietary exposures and funding of multidisciplinary research. In 2002, Dr. Sir wrote, chemo prevention by edible phytochemicals is now considered to be an inexpensive, readily applicable, acceptable, and accessible approach to cancer control and management. And finally, this quotation from Dr. David Servan-Schreiber in his book, Anti-Cancer, in 2009, every day, at every meal, we can choose food that will defend our bodies against the invasion of cancer. Thank you all very, very much.